today will be John 18:33-37. John 18:33-37. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called to Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I may not be delivered over the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You may say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I've come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice."
Morning. Just a quick reminder and an update on the announcement that was made earlier tonight. We are having the last of our training seminars that we've been having on Sunday evenings, and this one's over writing and delivering a devotional. One of the things the elders would like to do on Wednesday night is to kind of go back to the routine that we've had in the past, where we allow members who are interested in to deliver a devotional on Wednesday night service. We have some rules. So tonight, if you would like to participate in those devotionals, it is, can I use the word mandatory? If you want to deliver a devotional, you need to go through this class and hear what's expected of the person giving a devotional. Only the people that are in that class are going to be added to the list to give devotionals on Wednesday night. So at the risk of sounding mean, that's the way it's going to be. So I hope if you're interested in doing that, that you'll be here this evening and be in that class. This morning, we begin a sermon that's not from Hebrews, which is a break from what we've been doing for 7 or 8 weeks. We're going to look at a passage in John, the 18th chapter, dealing with Christ as king and Christ having a kingdom. This is the definitive passage for me about Christ and his kingdom and what it means for him to be king and to have a kingdom. I don't know if there's any passage that is more influential in the way I think about it than this one. In John 18, we're in the middle of the trial of Jesus before Pontius Pilate. Okay, so this is an important scene as part of the trial and the crucifixion ultimately of Christ. Here's what we read in verses 33-35. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" So verse 33 expresses basically Pilate's job description. Okay, Pilate has a very simple job description as a Roman official in this little troublesome place called Judea. Okay, what is his job? His job is to assess threats against the Roman Empire and to stop them. He has one job. If there is anyone or anything that looks like it might in any way rival the authority of Caesar, he's supposed to stop it. Now, normally what that means is just keeping general law and order, but also of great importance, if there is any person who comes along saying, the official Roman governors aren't in charge, or Caesar's not in charge, I am the king of these people, then Pilate's job is to arrest that guy and kill him. Usually, this is the way it works. Such a person would come along and say, I'm the leader of the Jewish people, I'm the leader of the Judeans, and he would lead some people off into the wilderness and they would start a little revolt, and Pilate and his guys would have to go out and enforce the will of Rome on them. On this situation, something really strange has happened that I'm guessing never happened to Pilate before or since. He didn't have to go and find someone who was a threat to Rome. He didn't have to go and arrest him. The Jewish people brought him to Pilate and in very suspicious context say, hey, we found a threat to Rome. We would like for you to deal with him. In fact, we'd like you to put him to death. Pilate is immediately suspicious because it's never happened that way before. The Jewish people are always protecting their rebel leader, and it's always Pilate who has to go and fight them, right? And this time, the Jewish folks said, "We found one for you. Go ahead and do your job." So Pilate is immediately suspicious, and what he does is he asks his one and only question. This is the only question he has to have answered. This, we call it a trial. For Pilate, it's a trial with one question. Are you the king of the Jews? If you are a person claiming to have authority over the people of Judea, then you're a threat to Roman authority, and that's the end of the conversation. If you're not, then you're not a threat, and Pilate doesn't care. He has a very simple job description. Jesus is determined to make his job that much more difficult. So Jesus engages in a little banter with him. He says, who told you that I was king of the Jews? How did you arrive at this conclusion? And what I think Jesus is doing here is pointing out the obvious with his little playful response. Does Jesus look like a king? Okay, here is Jesus. He's standing before Pilate. He didn't have to go arrest him. He didn't have to go put down his army in the wilderness. He's not wearing a crown. In fact, I'm guessing he looks a little bit like a carpenter's son from Nazareth. Okay, does he look like a threat to Roman authority? Pilate has seen a few of these. Jesus doesn't look like it. And so Jesus, I think, is playfully calling attention to that fact and says, Who told you I'm a king? Did you arrive at this conclusion yourself, or did someone else tell you? Don't you find this a little bit suspicious, Pilate? Well, Pilate's having none of it because he has one job description. He doesn't care about anything else. And he says, I'm not a Jew. Am I a Jew? He's not going to get involved in Jewish politics. He doesn't care about why they don't like Jesus. He really doesn't even care about justice in this instance. He has one concern. I don't know what you did, but your people brought you to me and said, this is a troublemaker. He's a threat to Rome. He's king of the Jews. And then he asks what is one of the most telling questions in the conversation. What have you done? And that's, you have to understand the suspicion of the case to understand why that's an interesting question, right? What have you done? When Pilate sent his guards out to arrest a thief or a bandit, like Barabbas, who's also in this scene, they knew before they went out what they had done, right? They knew that we're going to arrest a bandit. But they've brought you to me. What have you done that is so vile your own people want to bring you to a Roman governor they don't like? They didn't like Pilate. They never wanted to work with Pilate. And here they show up with a gift-wrapped prisoner and say, we're here to cooperate fully with the Roman authorities. Pilate says, what have you done? And it's in Jesus' response to that question that he articulates this grand doctrine of himself as a king and having a kingdom in a way that we need to understand. Unfortunately, in doing that, Jesus uses a phrase we probably don't understand. If you look in verse 36, he makes this grand comment, my kingdom is not of this world. Those of you that have heard me preach very often know that my preferred way of preaching is to pick one passage and pretty well stay there. That once upon a time, preachers measured their success by how many scriptures they could squeeze into the sermon, and I'm not from that school of thought. I would rather pick one passage, open your Bible, stay there, and I'll explain that one to you, and that'll be the sermon. However, to really get a sense of this phrase, my kingdom is not of this world, somehow I need to preach the entire Gospel of John in the next 5 or 10 minutes. So what we're going to do is a little game that we sometimes have in our sermons called quantity over quality, where I am going to just pile on you by means of PowerPoint slides as many passages as I felt necessary to make the point that this phrase of this world has a particular meaning in the book of John that now you're supposed to know when you come to chapter 18. Okay? It's going to be a little bit like sandblasting a soup cracker. We're just going to throw scripture out there until you finally say, yes, we get it. Okay, clearly John has made this point. Here's what it means when he says of this world. In the Gospel of John, I'm not going to ask you to turn to these passages, I'm just going to read them off just as rapidly as possible. In the Gospel of John, this world is the source of rebellion against God. Sin, evil, and wickedness originates in this world. And John uses that phrase repeatedly. One example that's noticeable is John 1:10, where he says, "He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him." That's a statement of rebellion. Okay? Jesus was in the world. Jesus made the world. The world did not recognize him for who he is. The world should have belonged to him. The world did not act like it belonged to him. And this is really the thesis for the book of John in a lot of ways, of the kingdom gospel of John. That it's Jesus' world, and Jesus was in it, but the world didn't know it. Why? Because the world is in rebellion against its king. The world is the place of evil and rebellion against God. Jesus enters this world sent by the Father's love. This is a point made repeatedly in John. In John chapter 10 and verse 36, "Him who the Father consecrated and sent into the world." How did Jesus get here? "I was sent into the world." John 11:27, "You are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." See, he didn't start there. He's coming into the world. John 12:46, "I have come into the world as a light." John 16:28, "I came from the Father and have come into the world, and now I'm leaving the world and going to the Father." So what's the point here? The world in John's gospel is the place where the rebellion is happening. Christ is its king, and now he has come into this world. He has come fully and completely. In John 1, he has put on flesh and dwelt among us. He has fully and completely come into this world to reassert the rulership of heaven. He's come as a light. He's come here on our behalf. Furthermore, Jesus is different in origin and nature from this world. How do I know that? Well, the last slide made the case. I was sent. Do you say that? Do you ever say that? I was sent in this world to be, that would be pretty preposterous. I mean, no human uses language like that. Makes you sound like you're a superhero. I came from the planet Krypton down to Earth. No, I mean, nobody uses that kind of language. No one says, "I was sent into this world." Jesus uses that language consistently. That his origin is not here. Oh, I know there's a place called Bethlehem, and oh, yes, I know there's a woman named Mary. But he says, "My origin is somewhere else, and my nature derives from that other place." Listen to these passages. John 14:27. "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives, do I give to you." Jesus says, "I'm here to give you peace." Oh, you mean peace? Like, no, not that kind of peace. Not a peace that you've ever known, because I'm not a person you've ever known. Christ is not from this world, and everything he has to offer is otherworldly, even though it's come into our world. Does that make sense? It's here. He's come here, but his nature and origin is elsewhere. John 14:30-31. "The ruler of this world is coming. He has no claim on me." You see, there's someone in rebellion against God who is pretending to rule this world. Jesus says, "He has no claim on me." He has claim on you. He has no claim on me. Why? Because Jesus isn't from here. Jesus' origin and nature supersedes everything we know about this world. He is from on high. And so the rebel and the rebellion doesn't pertain to him. John 15:18. "If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world, the world would love you as its own." Why doesn't the world receive Christ gladly? He says, "I'm not from here. I didn't originate from here. My nature is not from here. I'm here," right? He never denies that he's here. He never says, "I'm not really here." I'll make that very clear. He came into this world out of the Father's love. But his nature and origin is always another place. This world, then, is either saved or judged by Jesus. Christ comes into the world, and there's only two sets of results of that. And it's interesting, if you read John's gospel, that he'll go back and forth between them without really warning you. That sometimes he wants to make it very clear Jesus has come to save, and sometimes he wants to make it very clear Jesus has come to judge. And the answer is yes. It depends on your response to the king who has landed. Listen to this passage, John 3:16-19. This is a surprise to me, by the way, because we always quote this verse as the verse about God's great saving love, and it is. But remember that this is also a verse about God's terrible judgment That is part of the fact that he's come into this world. Listen to the verse, John 3:16 and following. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. And this is the judgment, verse 19. The light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. But which one is it, John? Is it salvation or judgment? And John says, yes. God sent Jesus to save you. If you don't want him, he judges you. But he has come into this world regardless. He comes in love. If you reject him in malice, then all you see is his justice and judgment. But the very fact that he's come into this world, the king has landed, and now it's the time for decision. You see, when there's a rebellion going on, there's this other guy who says he's king. Maybe you could say, I didn't know. Maybe you could say, I was deceived, I was tricked, I didn't know who was in charge. But once the true king lands and unfurls his flag and claims the throne for his own, you have to make a choice. He has come for your benefit. You either choose him or you don't. If you don't choose him, you have chosen the rebellion. You have chosen against your king. And so he comes to save. If you determine to stay in rebellion, then that saving act is also an act of judgment. John 12:31, now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. Hear that king and rebellion language? The king has landed and the rebel's time is done. The rebel could walk around saying he was the king as long as the king wasn't here. The king is here now, and that guy's got to go. The rebel is out, and now it's time for you to pick sides. Chapter 16, verse 11, the ruler of this world is judged. Right? The ruler of this world looks pretty powerful until he stands next to the actual king of the universe. And when you set him up against Christ, he's judged and found wanting. So Jesus' mission remains in this world. And John 9 and verse 5, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. John 16:33, in the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world. And in John 17, he prays for his disciples. They are not of the world, just as I am of the world, not of the world. I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. Okay, whole lot of passages. What was our point? This phrase, of the world, is not suddenly dropped down into chapter 18, and it's the first time John uses it. John has been consistently building a point. And what is the point? Number one, this world is in rebellion against its God and its king. Number two, God has entered into this world out of love in the person of Jesus Christ. Number three, having entered this world to save, if you don't want it, you find yourself meeting a judge. But furthermore, the king and his kingdom has a plan for this world. When he says that it's not of this world, he doesn't mean it's not in this world, because Jesus is here. He wants something to happen here and now, because he has returned to claim this world as his own. Now, with our quantity over quality section done, let's go back to the text I actually want to talk about, which is John 18, and let's start reading in verse 36 and see if we can understand what Jesus is saying. Jesus answered and said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I would not be delivered over to the Jews, but my kingdom is not from this world." What does it mean when Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world"? Well, it means, first of all, that his kingdom does not originate in this world. It does not come into existence because somebody conquered the Middle East. It doesn't come into existence because somebody set up a fancy chair somewhere and put on a crown. It doesn't come into existence because there's a constitution somewhere that says it is. It exists because of the declaration of the God of heaven that he is in charge. The word kingdom is a word we've lost in meaning. The word kingdom means the rule of a king. And wherever God is king, that is his kingdom. And what Christ has come to say is, I have a kingdom, But it doesn't exist by Roman authority. It doesn't exist by Herod's authority. It doesn't exist by Pilate's authority. It exists by the authority of heaven. It does not originate in this world. Christ's kingdom is not ruled by this world's power. All the rulers of the ancient world, like all the rulers of the modern world, are very happy for you to be religious as long as you're religious second. First, you need to submit to them. The Roman Empire was very pluralistic. You want to worship the Roman gods? That's great. You want to worship the Near Eastern gods? That's great. You want to worship African gods? That's great. You submit yourself to Caesar, and you can worship anybody you want. Christ is saying something different. He has a kingdom, and it's not a secondary kingdom. It's not something you can be second. His power is not granted him by Caesar. Caesar does not allow him to have a religion. Caesar does not allow him to worship God. Caesar does not allow him to obey. The God he worships allows Caesar to exist. The God he worships has power that is supreme over everything, and citizenship in that kingdom comes first and above all, because it doesn't originate here in this world's power. Christ's kingdom does not exert this world's power. And that was the part that was mystifying Pilate. Remember the conversation? What is Pilate's job? To stop threats to Rome. Jesus doesn't look very threatening. Where's his army? This is Pilate's job description. He's done this before. Jesus is not the first person who said he was king of the Jews. He's not even the last. Pilate's job is to go find these guys, wherever they are, find their little band of militants, and to subdue them with unwavering Roman force, right? To compel them to submit to the authority of Rome. And here is this person who simply does not seem to be exercising any of that authority, and yet claims to be a king. Claims to be a king so much that the other people turn him in for being a king. Right? The Jewish people say, you need to punish this guy, he's a king. But where's his army? And Jesus points to that directly. He says, if my kingdom were of this world, then I would have to exert this world's power. To be a king, I'd have to be a king like you, Pilate. I'd have to have some centurions. I'd have to have some people with swords and spears and whatnot. And yet that's the exact opposite of what Jesus does. Do you remember in the garden, they come to arrest Jesus? Peter pulls out a sword. Jesus says, put it away. It's the exact opposite of what a king's supposed to do in this world's exertion of power. And he can do that freely because his kingdom isn't of this world. What does that mean for Christians, by the way? Christians, this is a hard one to chew on. We've got to come to grips with it. I've been thinking all week about how to discuss this phrase, and then all morning, and then for the last hour, and then now still trying to figure out what I want to say about it. But let me say it like this. There are people in this world who demonstrate to us on a regular basis that they believe their religion can be accomplished and furthered by violence. All we have to do is turn on the television and look at events in France, look at events in our own country from time to time, look at events in the Middle East. There are people who believe their religion is advocated through violence. Christians, we have to make sure we remember that we don't believe that. I'm not a full-blown pacifist. I want everyone to know that. I do believe there are times of necessity where the government acts in order to secure safety and peace and things like that, and I'm glad for our veterans that take part in that and support that. I really do. But what Christians need to remember is no action like that furthers the kingdom of Christ. It may make for a safer world for a moment. It may help us get by for a little while, but at best, it is a stopgap measure because you cannot use violence to make Christians. You cannot use violence to change hearts. Charlemagne tried. Charlemagne conquered Europe and had one simple plan. Either be baptized or I'll behead you. Turns out he had a lot of baptized people, right? I don't think he had a lot of Christians, do you? Because you can't coerce people into Christianity. So while I appreciate what our government has to sometimes do in response to acts of terror and violence, as Christians we should know that is a necessary evil in a necessarily evil world, it turns out. But that is something that we do because we don't know what else to do. But there is no amount of violence that actually solves the problem. We don't want to believe what Islam has been saying, parts of Islam, that faith can be advocated through violence. We don't believe that. Christians have to be the people who are last in line for violent solutions. That somehow we are looking for every conceivable alternative because we know that exercising that kind of power doesn't accomplish what Christ came to accomplish. And that's a hard lesson. And in the world of global politics, I don't always know how that works out. I really don't. I'm glad I'm not in charge because I don't want to have to make those terrible decisions about the safety of people versus the use of violence. What a terrible set of choices that people have to make. As a Christian, though, I'm reminded from this passage that there's no amount of exercise of power that accomplishes the kingdom of Christ because it's not from here, and you can't be coerced into it. Rome could coerce you into being a Roman. Christ doesn't coerce you into being a Christian. It's accomplished differently. And the agency through which Christ exercises his heavenly power is not an army but a church. The weapon that he uses to change hearts and minds is not a sword but the scriptures. And that's the tool that goes out into this world. And it's a fundamental challenge to the ethics of Christians everywhere because it would be a lot easier if we could shoot the people who don't agree with us, especially if you have lots of guns, right? We would like to think there might be a simple solution, and Christ reminds us there is not. But it's going to be the harder road because his kingdom isn't like this kind of kingdom. Christ's kingdom does not originate in this world. Christ's kingdom is not ruled by this world's power, and Christ's kingdom does not exert this world's power, but Christ's kingdom certainly rules in this world. Why doesn't Jesus just answer Pilate, no? Wouldn't that have been easy? He's on trial. Are you a threat to the Roman Empire? No. There's the door. And it's the end of the discussion. That's all he has to say. And I have to think Jesus knows it. How do I think Jesus knows it? Because of how coy he's being with his answer. I know he knows that all he has to say is, I'm not a threat to Rome, and this trial is over. And he refuses to say it. Do you know why? Because he is a threat to Rome. The rulership of Christ is a threat to anyone who wants to have the power of this world. If you think you are in charge, you are not. Because Christ says that he is. And so he will not say, I'm not a threat to Rome. In fact, he goes quite the other direction. He says, oh, I have a kingdom. It's not like your kingdom. It doesn't fight like your kingdom. But I have a kingdom. And as king, he is sitting in judgment of Pilate at that very moment. That's the irony of this scene. I mean, it is beautiful on so many levels. Here is Pilate, a petty Roman official, who thinks he is exercising the power of the Roman military, the power of the Roman government, the power of the Roman Empire, the most powerful power this world has to exert to bring this man to heel. Jesus says, oh no, I'm judging you. You are on trial. The Jews are on trial. Caesar's on trial. This world is on trial because I do have a kingdom. It's just not like yours. There was one king in that room and it wasn't Pilate. One person casting judgment and it wasn't Pilate. It was the king with his kingdom. So read verse 37 and following and see if we don't make that point exactly. Then Pilate said to him, so you are a king. Pilate's ever the quick with picking up the implications here, right? In history, Pilate's never confused with an overly bright person. Pilate says, so you're a king? Can you just give me a straight answer? I have one question. You're supposed to answer it. It's real simple. Are you a king? No riddles, no proverbs, no prophecies. Are you a king? And listen to Jesus make his answer more direct. Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Are you a king? Jesus says, you say it. You have no idea how true it is. How many people had Pilate asked that question of? How many imposters to the throne had Pilate arrested and said, "Are you a king?" And then prosecuted them as imposter kings, as threats to the Roman Empire. Jesus says, for the first time, you're right. For the first time ever, you have found an actual king. For the first time ever, you have found an actual threat to Roman authority. First time ever, you have found someone who not only claims but demonstrates to rule the universe. Not only am I king, I was born to that end. I came into this world to be king. I have been born for this purpose. I have come into the world. There's that language again that John loves, right? I'm not from here. The only reason I'm here is to be king. Nothing could be truer. Nothing could be truer. The only reason I'm here is to be king. That's why Jesus can't deny it. When he was born, the angels shouted it from the sky. In his life, his father shouted it from heaven. In his death, Jesus affirms it. You bet I'm a king. And in his resurrection, the Holy Spirit will declare it with power. That he rules the universe even over death itself. Over the existential powers that Rome couldn't fight with. Death cannot even vanquish Christ. Because he's truly a king. And he rules over all. What's the message of this text? We need to reevaluate in our hearts and in our character what it means to call Jesus as a king. The day, listen carefully, the day that the statement Jesus is Lord or Jesus is king becomes unoffensive and non-controversial is a day that we didn't say it right. It's the most controversial and rebellious statement this world has ever heard. Because it is a rebellion against all the power of this world, all the powerful of this world, and all the exertions of power in this world. It is the declaration that everything you thought matter is false and only Christ reigns supreme. It is a radical claim. And the day it stops being controversial is the day we're saying it wrong. Listen to how the early Christians said it, and this will be our final passage. In Acts chapter 4, listen to how they understand the kingship of Christ. This is a prayer that they utter. Oh, that we could say more prayers like this one. Sovereign Lord, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and everything in them, who through the mouth of our father David, your servant, said by the Holy Spirit, why do the Gentiles rage and the people plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his anointed. For truly in this city, they were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. And now, Lord, look upon their threats and grant to your servants to continue to speak your word with all boldness while you stretch out your hand to heal, and signs and wonders are performed through the name of your holy servant Jesus. Listen to what the kingship of Christ meant to that people in that prayer. Sovereign Lord, who is Lord of the universe? God on high rules. He is the creator who's made all things. He spoke by our Father, his servant. David was the greatest king in Israel's history, but to the king of the universe, he is but a servant. You spoke through your servant, and what did you say? You said this was going to happen. That the Gentiles and the powers of the earth would fight against the one you've chosen to be king. And they said, we saw it. We saw it right in this city. There was Herod, there was Pontius Pilate, there were the Gentiles, there were the Jews. Everybody who thought they had power gathered around and tried to say they had power over your anointed. And they killed him and you rose him up. So what's the prayer? God, help us remember who you are. Listen to the end of that prayer. The same people who threatened and murdered Christ Jesus are threatening us. Help us to remember that you are king and yours alone is the kingdom. That the only power that truly matters in this universe belongs to the one to whom God has bestowed it, Jesus Christ of Nazareth. whom the scriptures rightfully claim, is not a king, but King of kings and Lord of lords. You need to reevaluate what it means to say Jesus is Lord. It's a radical claim. It is a claim that he, above all others, has constraints on your life. He, above all others, determines what matters for your life. He, above all others, determines how you will live your life. That he is fully and completely your sovereign and your king. If you've not put your faith and your confession in that radical claim and submitted to him in obedience, then we invite you to do it now as we'll stand and sing a word of encouragement. Won't you come at this time?